Hello everyone and welcome back to the Tudor Travel Show. It's Sarah, the Tudor Travel Guide here, and a big warm Tudor welcome to you all. Now today is the final episode in my In the Footsteps of Mary, Queen of Scots season. I really hope you've been enjoying our time travelling so far. Now before we go any further, I have just one or two important things I'd like to say. And the first is a huge thank you to all the patrons of the Tudor Travel Show who continue to support my work month in, month out. It helps fund me get out and about on the road to be able to record this content so that hopefully you can enjoy your own time travelling adventures. So once again, thank you to all my patrons. And if you have been enjoying this series and would like to support what I do here on the Tudor Travel Show, then you can head over to my homepage and you'll see the big green Become a Patron button. And there are a number of different levels of sponsorship that are available. Then, of course, I want to remind you that in June next year, between the 20th and the 24th, I will be leading an In the Footsteps of Mary, Queen of Scots tour for real in Bonnie, Scotland. And I will be visiting, with those of you who join me, all the places that we've been talking about in this podcast and more. So Linlithgow, Stirling, Edinburgh Castle, Holyrood, Falkland Palace, and enjoying the beautiful Loch Leven. So moving along, what can you expect from today's episode? Well, I'm returning to Edinburgh because, of course, I had to explore the castle. It was the scene, the place in which, of course, Mary gave birth to her son and heir, James VI of Scotland and the future James I of England. And I am delighted to say that despite the fact that we were battling with COVID along the way and COVID restrictions along the way, we did manage to get a private sneaky peek inside Mary's bedchamber and the very room in which she was delivered of her son. We were extremely lucky to do so, and I'm so excited to share that with you today. And then in the second half of this show, I want to welcome a very special and honoured guest. I was in fact granted a privy audience with Her Majesty Mary, Queen of Scots herself. Well, you can hear some of the questions that I put to Mary and just what she had to say to me in reply. And yes, I was certainly put in my place on a number of occasions. So make sure you listen through to the end to hear what I got up to in that particular tricky conversation. Okay, so we're going to go straight over back to Edinburgh now, and I will introduce you to our final guide along the way. So, buckle up, it's time to go time travelling. So, hello again, my time travelling friends. Welcome to this final podcast episode in our In the Footsteps of Mary, Queen of Scots series. And I'm delighted to have climbed up the Royal Mile to Edinburgh Castle, and I'm here with Donald. Donald, welcome to the Tudor Travel Show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me on.
So we, in a moment, are going to go in the footsteps of Mary up to her bedchamber.
That's correct. We'll go to her bedchamber and we shall show the birthing chamber where she gave birth to her only son in this castle in 1566.
And that's obviously one of the major, if not the major, event associated with Mary in the castle.
It is, yeah. And it was only by that she was up here, but she was up here because of what had happened previously down in the palace.
So we've been talking about that in a previous episode, but we may well touch on that again. But before we go on our walk through the castle and brave the weather outside, because it's pretty fearsome today, isn't it?
It really is. It's not a nice day at all.
No. But anyway, maybe you could just introduce yourself. Tell us who you are and what you do here.
I'm Donald Ferry. I'm one of the senior guides at Edinburgh Castle, and I've been working here for 18 years. So I've been doing guided tours of the castle for that length of time as well.
Wow, so we're in good hands today.
I hope so.
I know so. So, okay, so we are near the gatehouse currently, aren't we?
That's correct, refuge. We've gone through the gatehouse and we're actually in what was the stables.
I see.
This was the stables.
Would normally be the visitor, the ticket office, the visitor
It would be
centre.
Visitor centre, yeah. So if you had any queries when you get to the castle, you'd come in here and get your ticket in here.
Okay. But we're not concerned with that today. We are going to go on an adventure in time. Mm-hmm. So as we said, we're going to go up through the castle to her bedchamber. So why don't you lead the way, Donald?
Okay, no problem at all.
Well, at least it stopped raining.
It's not too bad now.
Just a little.
We're going to go through here and...
We've come up to, where are we now?
We're now at Mills Mount, which is the middle ward of Edinburgh Castle.
So it's in three wards, that sounds like
Yeah, you've
like
got
it,
the lower ward that we've just come up from.
Okay.
We've got the middle ward that we are in, and where the bedchamber is known as the upper ward.
So it has a very military feel, the castle.
Well, the castle has been a barracks since the 1700s.
It's
still a working military base today.
Ah, okay.
All these buildings that you see here on the right-hand side are all 18th century military buildings. This is the governor's house.
I didn't know it was still a
We still have the governor.
Military.
Yep.
Wow.
We actually still have the governor here today. It's called Alistair Bruce.
Mm-hmm.
He's the governor today. He is related to Robert the Bruce.
I was just going to say, there's a Bruce connection. That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
So we're certainly high up here. How high are we?
443 feet.
Okay,
from sea level. So about 200 feet from Princes Street.
And it's a pretty impregnable fortress, isn't it? Apart from the front entrance. I mean, you wouldn't
that
be able to...
That is the only way in.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is the barracks today. It's an 18th century barracks as well, but it's still used today as a barracks. So the army are still based here.
Ah, I see.
So then we're going to come through this gate here, which dates back to the reign of King Charles II. So a couple of monarchs after Mary.
Mm-hmm. He spent time up here, did he? Because I know he came to Scotland, didn't he?
He came to Scotland, but...
He was crowned in Scotland, wasn't he?
He was, yes. Yeah, he was. So we're going to take a right in that way there, look around.
So we're now in the upper ward.
This is the upper ward.
We're right at the pinnacle, right at the top of the castle.
Well, we have that building there, St. Margaret's Chapel. It's the oldest building in Edinburgh Castle.
How old?
The 1100s.
Wow.
It's actually the oldest building in Edinburgh.
So was that the original chapel for the castle?
It's the original chapel for the monarchs of the castle. There was another chapel that was on this side to our left here from the 14th century. Mm. And that was then changed into the war memorial, or to a barracks first of all, and then the war memorial after the First World War.
I see. It's a beautiful, the original chapel you're talking about is quite tiny, isn't it?
It's very small. You can only fit a small number of people in there. And it is still used today for weddings and christenings.
Is it indeed? This is the inner sanctum, isn't it?
This is the heart of Edinburgh Castle right here. This is Crown Square. which houses the royal apartments, the Great Hall, the Crown Room, and the War Memorial over there.
I see. You can tell immediately, can't you, the grand buildings and the heraldry, etc.
That was built by James IV, who was the grandfather of Mary, Queen of Scots.
Yes.
So
he was very busy building, wasn't he? That's one thing I've learned through this week. He was a very busy man.
He liked building his castle. He was the Renaissance king up here, is what he was known as.
Right, yeah.
So he built a lot of buildings throughout Scotland, in fairness. Okay.
Oh, I was just noticing that plaque up there.
That's to Mary of Guise, who's the mother of Mary, Queen of Scots.
So this is where she died. So the plaque says, Mary of Lorraine, Queen of James V, mother of Mary, Queen of Scots and Regent of Scotland from 1554 to 1560, died here on the 11th of June, 1560. A lady of honourable conditions, of singular judgment, full of humanity, a great lover of justice and helpful to the poor. She was obviously liked.
She was liked, she was, because she was looking after the throne for her daughter. Her daughter was in France until she was 18, as you well know, I'm sure. And she ruled here for her while she was away in France for her own safety.
It was a difficult year, wasn't it, for Mary, with the death of her mother on the 11th of June and then her husband, I believe, the same year.
That is the plaque for Henry, Lord Darnley, and Mary.
Is it now? So what we're looking at is a plaque. It's a sort of a, I don't know, is that a cartouche? Is that what you call it? With scrolls around, and you've got 1566 with the kind of entwined initials.
H&M.
H&M. So, wow. So, was that when this part of the building was built, or was that just added in honour of them?
I think that might have been added.
Okay. Lovely. Great. So, you've got keys clinking in your hands there. So we're going inside, again, out of the very blustery weather, and heading into the innermost sanctum of Mary, Queen of Scots royal apartments. This is an incredibly exciting moment for me. Thank you.
Come on in.
Oh, wow.
So here we are in the royal apartments, the bedchamber to Mary, Queen of Scots.
So this was her bedchamber once upon a time.
When she came up here.
So I noticed there was a progression of rooms. Would that have been the progression of rooms from the state apartments through into her bedchamber?
Yeah, basically you have the bedchamber here. You've got the presence chamber next door, and then the dining room the next door again. So if you were to come up to meet the king or the queen, you'd be left to wait in the presence chamber until such time as they were ready to see you.
Wow. And so which direction are we facing in here? If I was to see out of the window, where would I be seeing?
East.
East, okay. Because often they did face south or west, the royal apartments, to capture the sun. So I'm enjoying some of the paintings here. Yeah. Yes, do you want to tell me?
Yeah, absolutely. This one here is actually 19th century.
It has that Victorianised look about it,
I must
admit.
So the 19th century version of Mary, Queen of Scots, then her husband, Henry, Lord Darnley. Not entirely sure when that was done, but this one was done by Adrian van Son, who's a Dutch artist.
You've got the family tree, haven't you?
Starting with Mary.
Mary is married to Francois II.
Mary and Francois II, then Mary, then Henry, Lord Darnley, followed by James VI. But what it has here, this was the engagement painting for James VI that was sent to Anne of Denmark.
I see.
Okay, so it says on the top of it, it's written in German, Jakob der König, the King of Scotland there, because apparently the language of the court of over there was German.
Okay, good. So anyway, this was her bedroom. So this would have been a private space for Mary,
yes,
I guess.
Yes, absolutely. Only so you'd have her and the ladies in waiting.
Would have been in here. Maybe we could start telling a little bit of the story about, as we mentioned before, Mary's most suppose, famous visit to this castle. What was going on at the time?
Well, what was going on at the time was that you go back to March 1566, and she was staying down in the Palace of Holyrood House. And her husband, Henry Lord Darnley, had, with a group of his allies, killed her secretary, David Rizzio. Mm-hmm. And she felt, that was done in front of her when she was 6 months pregnant.
Yeah.
And she felt, well, I'm not safe here. So she came to the castle because she felt safer in the castle. And that's where she gave birth there in June of 1566.
It's because Holyrood's very different, isn't it? I mean, I was told that it did have a moat, but it was nowhere near like Edinburgh in terms of how impregnable.
No, it was more of a residence.
Palace.
Yeah.
So she came up here. Who did she bring with her? Who was she trusting at that time?
The four Marys.
So they would have all been here, wouldn't they?
I'd imagine so, yeah.
And in shock, I would imagine, at the time.
I'm sure at the time, yes, they would have been like, what's just happened? And let's just get up the road.
Yeah. You know? So did she come here straight away following that event?
Within the 3 months, anyway, of her giving birth.
Yes, right. Is this the actual room where she gets?
Yes. So if you come into here.
Wow, so we're just going through a stone doorway, birthplace of James VI, it says above the door. So we're going into a tiny little closet. Oh my goodness, it is small, isn't it?
Very small, and you might wonder how did she give birth in something like this, but she gave birth in a birthing chair, apparently.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, and that's how it happened. But what we see today in this room dates back to when James VI came back to Scotland in 1617.
Still pretty old. So what we've got, can you describe
what we have here? We have the coat of arms here in Scotland, written in Scots. Lord Jesus Christ, crown was with thorn, and it goes on. But the Scottish coat of arms with the lion and the two unicorns on either side, with Nemo me in tuine le cessit, which is the coat of arms of Scotland. The motto of Scotland is no one attacks me with impunity. Or we like to say here, if you hit me, I'll hit you back. And then on either wall, we've got the date that James VI was born. 19th of June.
Yeah. 1566. On the opposite wall.
And on the ceiling, you've got IR and MR. Jacobus Rex is James, and then MR is his mother, Maria Regina.
There's quite a commanding view. I can see through the window across the
down
city
to the grass market, which would have been bustling at the time, of course.
Yeah. And you can imagine her screams ringing out in this tiny little room. And the screams of the child that's born.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, I just want to thank you so much for bringing me in here. That's okay. Very, very special. I feel very blessed indeed. So, Donald, what happened to Mary after she'd given birth to James?
Well, after she gave birth to James, she would have left Edinburgh Castle, and she last saw James in Stirling in April of 1567. So he wasn't even 1 year old by the last time that she saw her own son.
And as far as we know, she never came back here to the castle.
As far as we know, she never came back. No, that was it. She gave birth here, and that was it.
That was the end of her history with Edinburgh Castle.
Yeah.
And as you say, she last saw her son just months later. And then, of course, as we know from the podcast that we've been doing so far, it all went downhill very quickly for Mary after that point.
It went horribly wrong.
Horribly, horribly wrong. So as we know, after Mary last saw James at Stirling Castle and rode away, she was within a short space of time abducted by Bothwell and taken by him to his castle at Dunbar. And shortly thereafter, she married him because, as Mary later said himself, he would not stop, i.e. it's been projected or it's been postulated that she was raped by him. Then the forces met, Mary's forces and those of the Confederate Lords met at Carbery Hill on the 15th of June 1567. And of course, at that point, Mary surrendered. And as we already know, she was taken prisoner. And ultimately, after being held prisoner at Lochleven in Scotland, eventually was freed, went on the run, and ultimately took refuge in England. But that's not quite the end of the story for Edinburgh Castle in relation to Mary, is it, Donald?
No, it's not, no. What happened was, first of all, Edinburgh came under siege in about 1571, and then the castle itself became known as the Lang Siege, and the castle was being held for Mary, Queen of Scots, against the forces of her son, James VI. So James VI at that time would have been 7 years old, so he wouldn't have known much about what was going on. But they laid siege to the castle for 2 years, and it only ended when, as I mentioned earlier on, that David's Tower, which is a tower that was built by the son of Robert the Bruce, King David II, that tower got hit by cannonballs. It then fell into the well in Edinburgh Castle, cutting off the water supply for the people here in the castle at the time, so they had no water. So yeah, if they have no water, they had to surrender the castle. So the governor of this castle, who was William Corrie Grange, he was basically told, he left the castle with his army, and he was arrested, taken down to where St. Giles is now, where he was hanged, drawn, and quartered.
Oh my goodness me. Well, I find that extraordinary, actually. I had no idea that the castle here was held for Mary on her behalf, 7 years into her imprisonment, basically.
Yep.
Wow. They were determined, weren't they, to get Mary back?
They were. It was, of course, it was shortly after the Reformation had taken place anyway, so it was a Church of Scotland versus the Catholic Church.
Yes, there was that
thing
religious
going on, that
tension.
Religious tension as well going on. So there was a lot still happening within Scotland at that time to bring about the fact that they were able to have a siege of Edinburgh Castle for 2 years.
Yes. So. Now, I think we were just talking before, and you mentioned that actually Elizabeth I supported the siege of the castle here
she,
at Edinburgh.
She is said that she gave weapons, some cannon, to help with the siege of the castle.
Yeah, well, you can imagine that it would be, obviously, with Elizabeth being of a Protestant leaning, that it would have been in her interest to see Catholicism once and for all stamped out.
She probably didn't want to have the country next to her having a strong Catholic monarch.
Absolutely.
Because if you think about it, if they had that, and then they had France, having a
sandwich
between the two of them, you know.
Indeed. So. Oh, well, thank you so much for taking us inside the castle and showing us these hallowed rooms, which really so deeply associated with Mary during what was becoming quite a traumatic period of her life. Thank you very much, Donald.
No problem at all. You're welcome.
Edinburgh Castle is such a mighty and austere fortress, it's really not hard to see why Mary decided to take refuge there after the murder of David Rizzio and in the run-up to the delivery of her son and heir. Anyway, I just wanted to say a massive thank you, first of all, to Historic Environment Scotland and to Laurie Risk, who helped schedule all my visits to the historic environment properties, including Linlithgow and Stirling and Edinburgh Castle. That's a massive thank you from me and to those staff on site who made us so welcome and helped us get into all the nooks and crannies despite all the COVID restrictions that were going on. Massive, massive thanks from me. Do remember, folks, that all these properties have pages associated with the Historic Environment Scotland website where you can get the latest on whether the properties are open and their opening times. And of course, they have been gradually reopening through the month of September, which is fantastic news. And if you're thinking of travelling to Scotland and visiting a number of these locations, it may well be worth picking up a membership for Historic Environment Scotland. I'll make sure that I put a link in the description below. Okay, so where do we go from here? Well, sadly, our tour of Mary, Queen of Scots, Scotland has come to an end for the time being. But I have been following in her footsteps, and it is always a privilege to do so. And of course, reading about her life story over and over has brought so many questions to the fore. Now, who better to ask those questions to but the lady herself? And I was lucky enough, as I said at the beginning of this programme, to be granted a very special and personal audience with the Queen. Now, being in front of a 16th century queen is quite an intimidating experience, but I hoped that I managed to ask all the burning questions that both you and I want to know answers to. But the question is, did Mary deign to reply?
I must say, Your Grace, you look absolutely charming and as beautiful as reports tell me.
My goodness. You really are a friendly ambassador.
Yes, indeed. And in fact, I would go so far as to say that I think perhaps Your Grace's visage is more pleasing than my English queen's.
Mon Dieu. This is quite the fancy.
Well, what I would like to do is to hear your story. And so all good stories have a beginning, do they not? So I thought that that's where we might start. And of course, you went to France at a young age, but you were in Scotland for the first 5 years of your life. And I wondered, Your Grace, what were your earliest memories of Scotland before you went to France?
Oi. Yes, well, obviously I was very young when we left, and we left in such difficult circumstances. But I do have some positive memories that I would like to share. The castle, of course, where we set sail for our fated journey to France. Dumbarton was a very safe haven for me and my Marys, my entourage. So I would say that perhaps this was probably one of the times that I felt safe in this difficult situation. You will know about the rough wooings and the recourse that happened with things that were in my early life. But Dumbarton was a place of security, a place where I could be without necessarily being concerned for my safety. Another place, of course, Stirling, some very, very happy memories in Stirling Castle. And this, again, another safe haven, but perhaps a more joyous time, a lot of courtly appearances. And I do have a few memories of sitting up to dinner with my mother and being part of court life in Stirling Castle, another haven. But I don't remember very much, to be honest with you. Scotland was a mythic country to me before my return.
Yes, because of course you were very, very young. So it's not surprising, Your Grace, that you don't remember much. Do you remember your mother at all from that period? Because of course, when you went to France, did you see her again after that?
I saw her once, which is much to my chagrin. My mother and I, under the circumstances, people forget that royal behaviour is not the behaviour of the people. We did not spend a lot of time together, but in many ways, my mother and I were very, very close. Kindred spirits. I really looked to my mother and saw the woman that I was supposed to be, but also, of course, the royal that I was supposed to be. She really led the way. So, yes, I do remember my mother at that time, but the time that I spent with her really were occasions, dinners and appearances and what have you. I remember her very fondly. She was very kind and very loving, which really, I think, was quite unusual under the circumstances. She had a lot of pressures on her, of course, because of the turbulent times that we were in, but she still made time to show me her affection.
Your Majesty, you always strike me as being a woman with a very passionate and loving heart, and I think one's parents help carve our character in that way. So in that respect, was your mother very much like you, do you think, in character?
Could I compare myself to my mother? Could I be half the woman my mother was? She was a very, very strong woman, and I aspired to that strength most definitely. But I think perhaps I am softer, more pliable. I think perhaps my mother had an idea of how she believed things should be and pursued that idea intently.
Thank you for that. And you mentioned Dumbarton, of course, that was the last place you were before you went to France to fulfill your destiny as the future Queen of France. Although, of course, you spent several years in France and there were many events that happened there. I'm focusing, if I may, more upon your time in your homeland of Scotland. So if we may fast forward to perhaps a very different time when you lost your husband, the King of France, you were a widowed queen, and I know that you were grief-stricken in that. And France had become very much your home, perhaps the only home that you really remember. So I'm really curious to know, why did you decide to come back to Scotland at that point?
I think you could say it was written in the stars. There were reasons, there were politics, I was supposed to come back to Scotland. It was fated. I should have come back to my people with my mother no longer at the helm. Everything was aligned that I should leave my position in France as comfortable and beautiful as my life was there and come and be with the people of Scotland, my people.
So you had a strong sense that it was your destiny, essentially, and you have maybe had a duty to do that?
I think that had things been different, life would have been very wonderful in France, very comfortable. My life in Scotland was not as comfortable, but very much my concern was to take up my destiny and take the role I had been given by God.
So you came back to France in August 1561, and came back from France, I should say, in August 1561. And I mean, Scotland and France, two very, very different countries, I guess.
Right.
Was it a shock? Were you surprised by, you know, the way court life was? And what things did you find most difficult to adapt to, Your Grace?
Well, on arrival in Leith, in the port of Leith, I understand now, having been apologised to and explained the situation. Our arrival was very much not the arrival that I anticipated, my grand return. We were greeted by no one on arrival, and I felt that this was quite telling, really, about the nature of the Scottish people. Although warm in many ways, perhaps sometimes a little slow and cold. And this, of course, was my experience compared to France. I was very lucky with warm climes and weathers that suited my temperament, I think. Adjusting to colder, darker, wetter climes, very, very difficult initially. And the people of Scotland, my people, I would have liked very much to have known my father. I am sure that if I had known my father, I would have more natural instinct to deal with the men of our country, the ruling men of our country.
Yes, they are, well, a difficult bunch, to say the least. At least that's what I glean from the people I know at the Scottish court.
They are fiercely intelligent, masterful in their concern. They are wonderful men, some really loyal and proud men. But yes, difficult, I think, perhaps, because of the time, because of the experience that they had, because they were not sure of who I was or who I would become and how I would rule, and they were confused by me, I think.
You talked about the ruling nobleman of the court being unsure of you, maybe, and I guess religion was a major part in that, because of course you were brought up in the Catholic faith, but you came back to a Protestant Scotland. So, gosh, that must be incredibly challenging. And I just wondered how that has been for you. What challenges have you faced, and what's been your experience of trying to negotiate that very difficult territory?
My personal feeling about this new faith, this Protestant faith, time will tell as to whether it will catch on, but I never had a problem with it. I think this is a misconception about my Catholicism. Yes, of course, I am very, very concerned with pursuing my own personal faith, and I am resolutely Catholic, of course, but I was brought up with manners, and I believe that if the people wish to take on this new idea and change the way that things are pursued, then of course they must pursue this themselves. And I really wished for peace. I wish for Scotland. We are in turmoil at the moment with this infighting and these men who change sides and speak whispers in the background. It confuses me greatly. I personally feel I have never had a problem with somebody who wishes to pursue this new, if strange, faith, but you must allow me to believe what I believe and allow for other Catholics to believe what they believe, the one true way.
So really, you're very tolerant in your approach. You never set out to try and diminish Protestantism or remove it from the country?
I think this would be a mistake, because by squashing something, you force it to go underground and you force it to come out at the sides and you force it to rise up and throw things over. And I think there is a way for both of these parties to exist side by side in peace. This is my hope. Well, peace for all.
Your grace shows incredible wisdom in such matters. Who do you count today? Who do you count as your closest allies and friends?
If I'm honest, in this time, I was doubtful as to whether I would take this meeting with yourself. And I mean no harm. I'm sure that you are, as you say, simply a friendly ambassador, but I do not wish to talk about allies. I am very concerned for my safety. I am concerned for the safety of my son. I am concerned. I must be very careful in these times, and I do not know you, madam. I do not wish to speak of this in terms of, please forgive me, because many of my men have seemed to be one thing and then have become another.
And therefore, I guess that it would be difficult for you to answer my next question, and that is, who do you think wishes you most harm, Your Grace?
I do not know where harm is coming, but I know it is coming. You do realise that my husband is dead. I should have been in. Kirkafield was the place I should have resided for this night, and it is all very, very raw, madam. Yes, I think perhaps we should pursue to a more happy line of questioning. Yes?
I will endeavour to do so, Your Grace. I do, though, want to touch on your late husband, but perhaps initially from happier times. You met your husband, Lord Darnley, and you fell very much in love with him, didn't you? When and how did that happen?
Yes, I have to confess that initially the match seemed a little forced. I know that he returned to Scotland from England, and he did so in rather dubious terms. He was not permitted a passport by my good cousin. And initially, he struck me as being, as we say in Scotland, a long, tall drink of water. Not necessarily something that I would have pursued, but I fell very hard for Henry. I nursed him. He had been very unwell, and of course he continued in his short amount of life that he had left to be unwell. And I was able to spend time with him and learn his softer side, and this endeared me to him greatly. I think it is no secret that his character was complex, but he had some redeeming qualities.
And they were, Your Grace?
I do not wish to discuss personal matters. I think perhaps I shall keep my memories for myself.
In which case I must press forward, perhaps into more difficult territory, and I beg Your Grace's pardon that I must do so, but these matters are of such great importance and interest.
To whom?
To myself, to those who perhaps wish to ally themselves with your cause, who love you greatly, madam, and equally fear for you, but would like to understand what has happened so that they may speak out more plainly in Your Grace's defence.
I see. Proceed.
Well, you did, as you say, fall for your husband very deeply, very passionately, and you were married very quickly, but it seems that your love for him dissipated almost as quickly as it had arrived. And I wonder what happened.
It is no secret that his character was troubled. It is no secret that the man enjoyed company within taverns and late night dinners. And of course, I am no angel. I also enjoyed the finer things of life, the evening pursuits, the music, the dancing. But when husband and wife cannot spend time together, and when husband cannot live up to the responsibility that he so passionately told me that he required, he needed to be, he claimed he was ready for the crown matrimonial, and yet he was nothing but a boy in his outlook and his pursuits of pleasure and happiness. Not with his wife, but elsewhere. I do not wish to speak ill of him, because he was complex and he did have endearing qualities. And perhaps, I should say something for him. He cared for me. He did. But I think he wanted power very, very badly. And I think he was very influenced by the men around him. And by that, of course, I mean the men around me.
And he, of course, was influenced to the point that I believe, if reports are to be believed, that he was involved quite recently in a plot to assassinate Your Grace's secretary, David Rizzio.
Was this a plot to kill Rizzio? My dear Davy, my dear, dear Davy. Was it simply a plot to kill somebody so close to me? Or was it an attempt on my life? I will never know this answer, but it makes me very fearful. I witnessed it. I was covered in his blood. And yes, my husband was behind it, and he apologized profusely following it. But can these things be forgiven? I know not.
How I understand that although your husband burst into the room and ahead of the group that murdered your secretary, somehow you managed to turn him back to your cause, and the two of you escaped. I know not how you managed to do that, Your Grace. What did you say to him to bring him back so that you two could escape together?
I think the bond between husband and wife is very strong, and I know that Henry, for all that he is weak, I keep referring to him as if he is still here. Henry was weak. Henry was influenced by what was around him. I simply reminded him of his duty as a husband, as a Catholic, as a man, and as the king, for he was the king, that he would not embarrass, nay, make my life very difficult. I had to be strong under the circumstances.
And you were. This is a very difficult question, but I must ask it. Your Grace must be aware that rumours abound in Scotland and in England about your involvement in the plot to assassinate your husband. I must ask you directly, Your Grace, please forgive me. Were you involved in this?
Madam, we do not know each other. We have simply met for the first time this evening, and of course I will not directly answer your question, but I will tell you this. I am a good Catholic woman. I believe in the right of the people. I am the ruler of the people, and I stand as a monument to peace. I wish for peace. I cannot stress this any further. This is what I want for my people. I do not want infighting and biting, and these men who are around me are causing these problems. I will not answer your question directly, but if you are listening to me at all, you will understand that it is out of my character to even be in the know of this. This was a plot, madam. Do not forget that I was supposed to be at Kirkafield that very evening. I am in mourning for my husband. Do not presume to ask me questions like this again. Thank you.
I crave Your Majesty's pardon for having to press such a matter, but Your Majesty also does touch on something that may well be, I'm sure, is very close to Your Majesty's heart, and that is, do you think that there will be long-lasting ramifications from what happened to your husband at Kirkafield?
I am simply going to say that I have to be very, very careful from now on. If I was not careful before, and I was, but I now really need to look as to who will be my ally going forward. Which of the men that surround me are double crossers and which are loyal? And of course, I know from experience that I cannot necessarily judge by character. I have a sunny disposition in the main and I wish to believe the best in people, but I think really this really is the second huge event. And of course, remember that I have to be very, very concerned for the safety of my son. He cannot even be with me, madam. We have to remove him from this situation and he will never know his father. And I understand that feeling very, very deeply. I will not have him endangered. No.
And that is, of course, why he is not with you currently. He is at Stirling, is he, Your Grace?
Yes, he is in Stirling. Fortified Stirling. Again, a place of very happy memories for me, yes.
I wish him well, Your Grace. Your cousin, my queen, Elizabeth, has had quite a bit to say on the matter of the events that have been unfolding. I'm sure you've probably heard of some of those things. I'm curious as to what you think of my English queen and what she has had.
Oh, madam, you are so presumptuous. What I may say of your queen, my cousin, my good sister, I very much hope going forward that our relationship maintains. I have the utmost faith that despite our differences of religion and our differences of opinion regarding ruling, that my cousin is strong and an incredible woman. And that is all I will have to say on the matter.
The two of you must feel, or you must feel empathy, and I can only imagine that my queen feels the same. Two female rulers in a man's world is no easy thing.
We are very different in our temperaments. We are very different in our characters, but of course I look to what she is doing and I am influenced by it. I hope in some way that if it's not too presumptuous that I may be influencing her too. We are completely different women and yet we are very much in the same boat, as it were. So yes, empathy, I feel empathy for a lot of individuals, but of course I have a natural kinship with my good sister.
And would you like to meet with her? Would you like her?
I have requested, excuse me for interrupting, but I think the record may reflect that I have requested to meet with her many a time. We have had endless correspondence. I am awaiting her arrival or our organised meeting. In York, we were supposed to meet, and then, of course, your country engaged in a war in Europe, and unfortunately, we were not able to meet. But I still live in hope that we will have our fated meeting and we will find the empathy there and then.
And I recognise that I have taken up a good deal of Your Grace's time. I perhaps just have one final question and maybe something to think of that is uplifting for Your Grace. You have recently, as you pointed out, delivered to your country an heir to the throne, and you must be delighted by doing so. Many congratulations. But I just wondered, you know, what were your hopes and aspirations for the future of the Stuart dynasty and for Scotland?
For Scotland, I wish for peace. I do. I wish for unity within the clans, within the men. I wish for the ruling to be considered and thought through, and for the people, making the people's lives better, because the people are what we are concerned with. They live a life that I know nothing of, and I have tried to understand their life and visit with them and be present in their life as their queen. For my son, well, I am still in correspondence with Elizabeth. I fear that she fears my advances, but of course I am looking for assurance of his relationship with England in the future. And I wish very, very deeply that if she continues in the vein that she has indicated to me she wishes to, if she were to continue to be a solo queen without husband and therefore no heir, that my son would become the heir to the throne of England. But I make advances and we are received with a brick wall. We shall see. I shall continue my efforts in diplomacy and connection with the English crown.
Well, as you say, Grace, we will see and time will tell, but I fear that I have taken up far too much of your time and can only thank Your Grace most deeply for taking time out of during a very difficult time for Your Grace, I know, to speak with us today. I am most, most grateful.
De rien.
Oh, that was such fun, wasn't it? How did you think I did? Did I manage to hold my own? Was I intimidated? Yeah, you bet. Anyway, moving into the 21st century, of course, I have to thank our Mary, and that is Helen Quinn, who is an amazing actress who gave very generously of her time in full regalia and certainly made me feel as though I was playing the part of a very, very impertinent English quote unquote ambassador. Now, for those of you who'd like to find out more about Helen, who has been performing as Mary Queen of Scots since 2012, you can pop over to her website, which is maryquinnofscots.com. And that's Quinn, C-U-I-N-N. So that's Mary, C-U-I-N-N of Scots.com. And in fact, I'll put a link to Helen's website in the text description below. Well, we really are coming to the end of this very special season. I just feel that there are so many people I would like to thank, and I hope I have done so heartily along the way. But perhaps just one more thanks to the Mary Stuart Society. And do remember, folks, that you can become a member of the society. They have a very active programme, both in Scotland and in England. And there are many members throughout the world, as you heard from Liz Manson herself. So once again, do pop over to their webpage, have a look at what they're up to, and you can sign up for membership. And I will put another link in the text description associated with this podcast. So next month, it's back to normal, which unfortunately just means one episode a month. However, it's a cracker as I go to one of the lesser known Tudor properties in the Midlands here in England, and that is Harvington Hall. Now, Harvington Hall is renowned for its raw authenticity and particularly its many priest holes. And I'm going to be meeting up with house manager there, Phil Downing, old friend of the Tudor Travel Guide. And we'll be diving into a lot of those different holes and hearing the stories about this really magnificent old house. So I look forward to you joining me then in October. And until then, my friends, it is, of course, happy time travelling.